For those of us that have been involved in Philadelphia ULT or elsewhere for decades, this is quite a chuckle. It's a traditional presentation that we open the winter session with. And each class, whether it is a variety of the classes in October and November that treat the subject more fully, or the Wednesday night study classes in the ocean, each class is a communion of soul, isn't it? It's a gathering of students striving to explore and understand the philosophy of theosophy. We each come to this study from a variety of different avenues of life, a variety of different memories of what it means to study this wisdom religion, this divine wisdom. And we come to this with the anticipation that the philosophy is anything except it is not a set of teachings or premises that there can be faith without works. No, rather, the philosophy depends on this combination of faith, the internal and the external expression of that faith, of that philosophy, if you will. So, what is theosophy? This divine wisdom, this philosophy that is eternal and all encompassing in so many ways that attracts so many souls around the world to this teaching in a communal effort to understand and apply it. Well, it's a philosophy based, first and foremost, on the notion or the truth that there is an identity of all spiritual beings, that we are one in the collective, even as though we appear to be manifest in a multitude of individuality. It is a philosophy that teaches resignation in a certain degree. And as students, we're attracted to this. Even the general public that may never have heard the word theosophy, there's an inner drive, there's an inner urgency, if you will, to figure out what is true about life. Where do we come from? How does life unfold? What's it all about? These urgent, eternal questions, and a sense that within each of us, there is a degree of self-identifying premises. There's a degree of progress that we ourselves can judge things for ourselves in critical thinking, in awareness, in the ability to puzzle piece everything we see around us into an overall, all-encompassing view of what life is. And we know also there are folks that are attracted to, well, what's this definition? What's the intellectual premise behind this? Or theosophy means an organization, or it means a building, or it means a combination of students, or it means some sort of sanctuary of serene thought that I can come to in terms of public meetings every week in a cyclic way. Well, that itself is a chuckle because we know that as there are 18 million years as a premise of self-conscious entities, human beings as an expression of soul, of mind, of heart, of spirit. And we know that we just spent an entire summer looking at a 5,000-year-old, actually older now, text of the Bhagavad Gita, looking at what was it like 5,000 years ago to look for divine wisdom, to find the truths that underlie all of life. Where then we could chuckle, well, in the early centuries of the Common Era, there was a Neoplatonic effort in Alexandria, Egypt, They use the word theosophy. And then others of us might chuckle still further and say, yeah, but you know what? In the 17th century, there were thinkers like Jacob Burma and Robert Flood and others who used that word in a study of great nature based on mystical, intuitive, and symbolic knowledge of what divine nature was all about. And underlying all of that, we have the confidence that in 1875, we have the efforts of Blavatsky and her workers, co-workers, who brought forth the historical, what would you call it? I guess the historical lineage of what this great body of thought, of philosophy, of wisdom, of science, of religion, what it was all about and how it developed. And then moving still closer to our own time period, we know that starting in 1909, ULT in centers like Philadelphia began to bloom around the world, again with this notion of, let's look again at this ancient line of thought that seems to be impressed within the heart of each human being, which seems to rise up periodically in a collective outward manifestation. And let's get back to the eternal verities, the fundamental changeless points of truth about this philosophy. And so we flash forward to this morning's effort, all of us together, to come with our own recollections of how we came to discover theosophy in this incarnation, how we came to discover ULT Philadelphia in this incarnation, and what it's like to have a dual notion of what theosophy is. On the one hand, a philosophical, abstract, speculative doctrine that we mull over from within and we explore within our own minds and hearts and judge and discern from our own intuition, and what it's like to try to manifest that in a more overt, productive, shall we say, combined and shared reality. Well, if we hold to the three fundamentals of this philosophy, the first being that there is a universal oneness to all of spiritual life, and that it is expressed in the human kingdom as rays of the deific, assuming the mask of the human state, the self-conscious state. We're reminded of our summer studies in which Krishna, as that spiritual oneness, that innate deific essence, has a communication, a colloquy with Arjuna, the outward personal manifestation of an incarnation. And we remember Arjuna saying things like, I'm a disciple, I'm looking for instruction about deity, I'm confounded about the duties that I see in front of me. And Krishna, that eternal witness within, begins to communicate with that lower degree of mind and begins to explain about the true nature of self being one, eternal, changeless, all-powerful, and far greater than any finite body or personality, any expression of karma, any expression of the reincarnate soul. What we begin to realize is that there's a duality already. There's the deific permanent first fundamental that the philosophy teaches as a premise. There's a second fundamental that there's an outward manifestation of that fundamental oneness, and that's based on cause and effect, karma, reincarnation, the development of self-fulfilled and self-devised efforts, life upon life upon life. And the philosophy has a third premise that as self-conscious entities, rays of that oneness, as we incarnate from life to life, facing duties of a natural calling that come to us, that are attracted to us on the basis of karma, that we are faced with an ultimate third fundamental proposition, that we come together in order literally to fit ourselves to be the better able to help, to impress, to uplift, to empower all of self-conscious entities in incarnation. We're invited to resign ourselves that regardless of what we experience as soul, no matter what we witness, the high up, the low down, the painful, the pleasurable, loss, victory, gain, defeat, all of it is exactly the same transitory experiences that we can use if we resign ourselves to the life and plane of spirit. We can use all those opportunities to endeavor to make theosophy, this spiritual philosophy, a living power in our life as we begin to attune ourselves to that voice of conscience, that voice of the silence within, and as we begin the divine, theosophical, wise course of action of impressing life with ethical causation. And so we come to this, theosophy is a philosophy, but then the question becomes, well, how does that translate? How does that manifest? And we have a second panelist.
So, theosophy, how does it manifest in our life? Well, we just heard that there must be a basis on which we think. And we come to the very basis of our own being, and that is that first principle, that there is that which is eternal, boundless, immutable, omnipresent. It is from which everything has come forth. The analogy or the imagery is of a great breath coming forth, which in our minds, we picture motion, but it's from this oneness that all life has proceeded. So when we come to theosophy, we are given an analogy, and it's like we are a drop in that great ocean of life, or we are a ray of that great sun. Well, what great sun are they talking about? Well, the sun we see in the sky? No, there's something behind that sun. That great, there is that sun which we do not see, but it is ever shining forth. And that sun we see in our heaven is just a reflection of that. So we are, if we are a ray of that sun, that means that we are rays of light. And that connotates that we are rays of love. We are rays of kindness. We are rays of the pure human spirit that lies within all of us. That there's a phrase that we have heard is that children of light, as you go forth into the world, seek to do gentle service to all that live. So this is theosophy. Theosophy is living the life. And what is that life? That life is based upon law, about karma, reincarnation. It's about our journey through time. Theosophy is a way of living. It's the art of living. We are given the tools to live a life of service. And how to do that? How to become more of a human being that is evolving from that lower animal, passional nature. We are all on a journey, and these rays of light have penetrated this material world, and all that we see are rays of light at different degrees of expression on this evolutionary journey toward self consciousness and godhood. Theosophy is the philosophy of the heart, and it's practiced universally. It's the religion of the spirit, which is free and immortal. And it's the science of life, moving in directions of universal self-consciousness. This is achieved through self-reflection and self-correction and growth from within. This is an individual journey that all souls must take, because karma grants us the ability to keep on moving forward and giving us the opportunity to ever perfect our being. Because as we have learned from this first chapter in the ocean, is that there are these perfected beings in the universe. That we are, as human beings, perfectible. That we are not separate. And that we see the most heinous crimes committed by those who feel that they are. Theosophy is about the absolute, which is altruism. Compassion is the law. We think that we are moved by compassion, but that's what we are. The more we tap into that, the more our heart opens. Our mind will free our heart so that it can operate. But beware, the mind can also tie down the heart and tie a knot in our heart. So we must endeavor to free the mind. And we do that by living the life. And that life is mapped out in the Bhagavad Gita. The Gita encourages us to be focused, to be concentrated, to do each task with our full attention. And that as we do these things, we should do them because they are what needs to be done, and not looking for the reward. Which alludes to the fact of selflessness. We are inherently selfish because we think we are separate. But when we free ourselves from that, we are unselfish. But we are unselfish now in many ways. But we are still tied down. Our way we are to our freedom is that selflessness. And we do that by not looking for the rewards of our actions, but doing what needs to be done and let the results to the law. We live in a difficult world. So theosophy becomes our comfort, becomes our refuge, because our mind, our lower mind, is captured by the activity of our daily life. We need to separate ourselves from that lower mind, to look on it impartially and with discrimination. And there we can look by self-reflection, by self-correction, we can grow from within. Theosophy is all about humanity attaining its freedom, a freedom from wrong ideas. And that is what binds us down, the wrong ideas that we hold to be true. Theosophy invites all of us to investigate on our own, to uncover the truth that lies hidden within theosophy. Remember, the knowledge of theosophy is latent within every human being. Our duty, our responsibility, is to awaken that within humanity the best that we know how, and with the sincerest of effort. And it said, no sincere effort ever is wasted. So, to make theosophy a living power in our life is all of our endeavors. We are given so many ways of doing that. It is our duty to find the way which best suits us, and where we can thrive and be happy within and joyous that we are doing the best that we can, and that we are kind, and that our hearts are filled with love for each other, because that is what we are. Our feeling of separateness creates all this darkness. Again, I think as this all began, we are a great unit. We are a great oneness. We are attached to each other in so many ways. So when we come to this endeavor, we see our attachments once more. And it's good being amongst friends and people that think alike. Well, we could say much more, but we'll give you the opportunity to contribute as you see fit. If you have questions, we dare you to ask them. Yes, SL.
From what's been presented, it's clear that theosophy is a body of knowledge. And we, body of knowledge, there must be those who know it. And the invitation is there for us to know it. But at least the life we're living now is kind of short, relatively. What can we expect to find in theosophy if we make the effort to study it that we might not be able to find in other courses of study? Because there's so many options out there. We spend this life just trying to learn about how to take care of our body better or how to relate to be better. What in our nature would compel us, or why would we want to study theosophy? What makes it different?
Well, we can only speak that once we began studying this philosophy, reincarnation connected us to this life. That we began realizing we are not living for today, we're living for tomorrow. And that all our actions and our thoughts, our words, our deeds follow us through life and lives. So that we began to think more responsibly and try to act more responsibly and taking responsibility for our own life.
Reincarnation is said to be the lost chord of Christianity, that across the last 2,000 years, certain truths that were eternally accessible and acceptable were lost. So from a theosophical point of view, if we throw up our hands in despair and say, well, wait a minute, I may have 70 or 100 years of this incarnation, and I sleep half the time, and I lose another eighth of the day in meal preparation, or I'm so busy earning a living, doing the laundry, washing the dishes, whatever it is. That's a finite sempiternity identification with the personal. And the philosophy of theosophy invites us to see life as a tremendous spiritual continuity, a continuum that goes on from one incarnation to another, in which we generate a force of light and love, and therefore create attractions and repulsions to what we feel to be true. And that this cause and effect process happens not just over this one little incarnation, but no goes on life after life after life, endless opportunities, tremendous opportunities to correct, to support, to empower others, to serve in every sense of the word. And so those truths of karma, reincarnation, this endless existence of spirit, it's a very different set of tools with which to approach the problems and the high points of this particular incarnation.
Yes, Theosophy Hall. Mike, you're...
We know that in the Bhagavad Gita, we're told that we should do our duty as it comes to us. And we also are aware that karma brings duty to us so that we have lessons. Because we have lessons, we have to learn. So our question is then, we know that we also know that theosophy encourages us to serve, and we do that on an independent way. You know, it's not as if the group, you know, has a project. We each choose our duty as it comes, how we serve. So should we sit back and wait for karma to bring opportunities to us, or should we be going out and actually looking for these services that we need to provide?
Well, you know, when we become aware of existence in the morning, head is still on the pillow, we don't yet know who we are, where we are, what the list of duties for the day are. That inner existence is an exemplar of that eternal being within. And with each breath we take, as we become more and more conscious of the personal human being and the list of duties for the day, the whole attitude of mind, the whole thinking premise from the heart, the sense of compassion and the point of view of hope and confidence, that's doing our duty before the head even comes off the pillow, before there is even a sense of awareness of what's going to unfold that day. And as we generate that sense of existence, as we generate those basic premises, those basic ideas with which we can meet the day, we set up magnetic ties and attractions that will follow us moment by moment by moment as the day proceeds. And so with every step of the way, in the most mundane sets of fashion, we stumble down the steps and we have this errant thought, maybe even a little curse or frustration or anger. In that moment, if we can catch that passing thought and correct it and ameliorate it, we've begun to do duty. And if we trust in the law, if we remember that we're not waiting for some great and astounding occurrence, there's no dramatic kind of duty that may come to us moment by moment, but rather this may be a very natural unfolding of the day, the way the sun comes up, the way the tides rise and fall. And we will attract to us naturally, organically, by a primal kind of effort, we will attract just the right accomplice, just the right acquaintance, just the right event with which to test out these fundamental premises of the philosophy.
Yeah, and it's the old adage. We make the day. The day doesn't make us. It's we are the generators of force and activity. Our minds are dynamic generators of force. And as explained, we are so dynamic that we have these tendencies that we have colored, and they are attached to us. And even from life to life, we attract them back to us. These tendencies of our being, of our lower personality, the things that we need to ameliorate. So opportunity comes to us. We just don't recognize it as an opportunity. We just think it's something else to, what my daily activity, but maybe not so. Maybe there's something within that we missed, you know?
What comes to mind also is the Steinbeck literature of Mice and Men. You know, the quote of the best laid plans of mice and men off go awry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we may plan, I'm going to be this tremendous crusader and do these huge things out in the external world. And while we're planning that, life happens. You know, with the turn of a day, there could be a whole new circumstance that arises, and it will come to us. We don't need to travel around the world to be a reformer. It's nice if we've got the leisure, time, energy, and health to volunteer and to serve in a variety of different associations. We're invited to become active in terms of being a citizen of the town and the neighborhood and the state. All that is good and well. The action begins in the thought. The same way the philosophy begins with an internal premise of activity and generation. That's where duty begins as well. SL, your hand was up.
We've read that theosophy means divine wisdom or spiritual knowledge or soul wisdom. Well, we have heard generally from a number of sources that we are souls, but what exactly does theosophy mean by that? What is it? How do we know we are souls? What is the nature of our soul?
Well, the nature. Yeah, well, that's very important, because we're told that the absolute is unchanging. It is not change. So we are told to search, you know, by self-reflection. Search for that witness or that observer that we are, that consciousness which we are, which observes the change, and develop a relationship with that observer, so that during the day you can befriend that observer and let him, you know, let him become present, or let her become present within your daily activity.
And in many ways, again, this starts within, with contemplation and reflection in thought. And we can each sit with the notion of what's the difference between I am soul and I have a soul. If the notion is I have a soul, it was endowed, it was given to me as a possession, as a thing, as a finite entity by an external creator. That's a very different basis for life, for living, from the notion of there is this absolute, beyond knowable, all-encompassing, without any attribute at all, this absolute that emanates, radiates, manifests different degrees of, it becomes diverse. As Krishna says, I am one and I am one among many. That diversification, that kaleidoscope of oneness, means that resident within each deific essence is soul, all powerful in potential, perfectible in potential, not a gift, not earned, it just is. And on that basis, if we live from that basis, there's a fearless possibility of confidence, of hope, of correcting any course of action that we intuitively see is not ethical or is flawed in some way. If we find out our motives are mixed, and that with lack of knowledge, we may have acted from a fine motive, but the effect was such that we handicapped or limited another being, we can correct it. We can overcome it. And there's an old phrase, to err is human, to correct is divine. The soul can correct itself, and not wait to be saved or in some way magically cured. SL?
Well, we've had this morning presented very importantly, the idea that theosophy is a body of knowledge that we have to search for within and discover for ourselves. But what about these books that we study, like The Secret Doctrine, so forth, Isis Unveiled? What do they tell us about theosophy is? We think what it is. I think at one point we read that it's the recorded wisdom of the ages. So there must be a record of it somewhere.
Well, that is what theosophy is, a recorded record of these ancient teachings. And I think it was mentioned that 18 million years that we have been self-conscious, and that you know, that we only have we reflect on the Egyptian dynasty of thousands and thousands of years, or three sidereal cycles in the Temple of Sanhedrin. So, you know, we think that's a long time, but 18 million years is quite many incarnations for us. So, well, we don't know where we were going with that.
Well, the literature that was pulled together, collated in the late 1800s, reflects the endeavor of certain souls to wake us up, to wake the Western world up to the realities that there is this body of wisdom, that it seems to be impressed in human nature. It appears that psychically it can be proven or applied or manifested across time in a variety of places among all peoples everywhere. And what's the invitation to the modern thinker, to us? Our invitation is to read The Voice of the Silence as a contemplative, mystical kind of a book, to look at Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine as a handy dandy collation of research that we probably could not accomplish in this incarnation. It's too vast, but we can look at different portions that we're attracted to and then sit and figure out, okay, now this has been said in this religion and that's been said in that religion. Where are they same? Where are they different? What seems to be measuring up to those three fundamental propositions? How can we intuitively begin to discern what is fake and what is real? There's an Old Testament, there's a New Testament in the Judeo-Christian world. Sometimes they're re-edited and supplemented and reworded. But in essence, if we compare some of the teachings and the oldest portions of those texts, maybe that have been least dabbled with by human editors, where do they line up with the Gnostic teachings, with the Hindu teachings, with the Buddhistic teachings? Where is the sense of the Islamic submission to a deity? Where does that and how does that line up with this entire notion of our resigning ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally to the spiritual? How does it all compare and measure up? Again, as individual souls, we're invited to a table, a tremendous feast of ideas and historical traces, but we're invited there to be the consumer, to think about it, to analyze it, to assimilate it, to apply it, and then offer it on to others.
And even for those that want to become imbued with this philosophy, read the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. We are told that, you know, we can read the words, but the real meaning is between the lines. Well, what does that mean? That there's a deep meaning that lies within it that touches the soul. By reading it and by studying it, we nourish the soul. We nourish it by recognizing that it exists. You know, that we are soul beings. You know, that we only have these bodies as a means of gathering experience on this plane. So the Bhagavad Gita is a refuge, not only for us, but for those who have perfected themselves more than we have. But we must keep on reminding ourselves that what is our ideal? Our ideal are those Mahatmas, those perfected beings. Sure, I may not attain that in this life or many lives to come, but it's still an ideal. It's still that my effort is not wasted, that eventually this desire to be among them, to commune with them, as we do in deep sleep, you know, will be fulfilled. But our motive must be altruistic. We must be not doing it for ourselves, but for we must be doing it selflessly for all. Nothing, no one is left out of our heart and hopefully our actions.
But each of us comes to this pursuit, to this sacred endeavor, with a variety of talents and tendencies and earned points of view that need to be revisited, perhaps. And this Mahatmas as real, perfectible souls that have moved through the human state. They're real. They're also ideal for the rest of us to envision how to go about correcting life and using life for bettering conditions. That ongoing process, no matter how we approach this, some of us may come to this study and say, well, I can see in the Gita that there's guidelines for improving physical health, or I can see in the Gita that there are guidelines for improving mental health, emotional health, and stability. Or somebody else may see in the Gita guidelines for how to stifle the false sense of pride and self in the personal, and how to raise that point of consciousness to be universal and all-encompassing and all-influential. However we come to that effort, whatever our starting point is based on our own tendencies from past incarnations and past decades, in this moment, we are about the business of perfecting the physicality, the emotionality or psychic nature, the intellectual or mental nature. We are about perfecting the balance between the individual and the collective. And as we purify and refine personally, we have confidence that we're actually clearing the pollution of the lower personal nature collectively, so that we can assist all others struggling to be free, all others struggling to begin this process. And therefore, we're companions to the masters. We may not be masterful. We may not even be perfectible as we think about it as personalities. But as we make this endeavor to think and to feel from a loftier plane, a more idealistic, ethical plane, we help to make all the materials of manifestation improved so that they too can be used by those far more masterful than ourselves. On behalf of those who are far less masterful, who just cannot transmit that ray of soul yet, but we can help them along.
Theosophy warns us of the great sin of separateness. And we always sort of pass that off. Oh, sure, we understand that. But we live in the reality of this physical world where we see us as being separate. It is so ingrained in our nature that is sometimes we overlook it. The physical world denies that theosophy exists. That is the great endeavor. That is the great struggle. That is the great fight between the higher and the lower. That struggle is always going on. It's going on within our nature and outside of our nature. But when we look for the answers outside of ourselves, we find a world like we have today. Everyone is looking for the answer outside themselves. The answer lies within. Know that thou art Buddha in our very nature. We are Christos. We are that light of that sun. And we cannot forget that. The paramitas begin with that virtue of love, because that's what we are. We are love manifest. It's through that that we have come into existence. For the love of life, Tanha. And through that love, we have touched all of the lower kingdoms. And we are raising them up to higher states of consciousness. And the ultimate goal is self-consciousness, where we are. We have won this opportunity. Now, what are we going to do with it? And theosophy shows us the path back to where we belong, as a unity, as harmonious, and not separate from each other. We are a solidarity, and we need to act as such.
And that line of thinking is not unique to modern students of theosophy, but rather reflects the written word as we knew it over 5,000 years ago. In closing, these are the words of the Gita. It is even the same exhaustless, secret, eternal doctrine I have this day communicated unto thee, because thou art my devotee and my friend. Seek this wisdom by doing service, by strong search, by questions, and by humility. The wise who see the truth will communicate it unto thee, and knowing which, thou shalt never again fall into error, O son of Bharata. The words of Krishna inviting us to commune in this tremendous effort, so that we never fall back, not one of us, not any, for we are one. See you Wednesday night.